Okay, guys, thank you for inviting me to do this today. I'm going to be talking about our study of university students in Northern Ireland. The study was called the Ulster University Student Wellbeing Study, very creative title there. It's part of a worldwide study of college students led by the World Health Organization, and there's over 13 countries currently involved with various different universities and colleges from each country there. And the idea is that we would do longitudinal studies within our student populations to look at risk factors, protective factors, and ultimately start to test interventions for students. So the Dutch group that are involved in this are now using some online interventions, which we're hoping to pilot test in Northern Ireland too. So it's a massive study. We recruited a first year across all of our Ulster campuses, all four, in 2016. Over 1,600 students signed up to the study, and we've managed to get 739 fully completed surveys so far. Now, we had up to 1,000 who were partially completed, and we're still chasing up students. We have 1,600 DNA samples, saliva samples, so there was some crack trying to get students at registration to give us their saliva, and there were bucket loads of sanitizer needed as well for that. So the saliva sample is really interesting, and Elaine's going to be telling you about that as well. So I'm just going to batter on with the key findings here. We looked at the various different mental disorders. We used the psychiatric diagnostic criteria, so the criteria that psychiatrists would use to establish whether people met the requirements, I suppose, for a diagnosis of each of these mental illnesses. And all the figures are up there. And what I wanted to do was draw your attention to some particularly shocking and interesting figures from our perspective. So the first one is depression. So it's in there as major depressive disorder, MDD, mood disorder. And we all know what depression is. And we find that a quarter of our students, almost a quarter, had depression over the course of their lifetime prior to attending university. Now that is much higher than the general population. So that gave us some concern. But when we look at the figures for GAERS for females, we find that it's even higher still. It's 27.7%. And the earlier presentation there on media and how women interpret that and how it affects their body image definitely plays into that. One of the things that's quite interesting, though, was the male figures are approaching the female figures for this group. There's not such a big gender difference anymore, which is quite interesting, but the women are still at higher risk than the males. Anxiety is by far and away the biggest mental health problem that's affecting our college student population. And with 22% of our students suffering from generalized anxiety disorder. We don't know much about GAD. We don't talk about it much, but it's a very, very common mental health condition. And it really impinges on that person's life and their ability to carry out the roles, such as working, studying, caring for people, whatever. So that's 1 in 5. Again, it's higher in females, just over a quarter there, 26%. Alcohol dependence, we know our students do like a wee drink, as many of us do. The alcohol dependence figures are 10%. So 10% of students are dependent on alcohol. Now, to meet the diagnostic criteria for alcohol dependence, it needs to be having quite an impact on your life. So we know lots of our students are drinking, but the idea that 1 in 10 come to university and they're already addicted to alcohol, that really was quite shocking for us. And I haven't drawn out the gender differences there because the differences aren't statistically significant. There's slightly more males than females, but this is an issue that impacts on both males and females equally, I feel. My own particular area of interest is suicidal behaviour and suicidal thoughts and ideations. So suicide, we generally look now at suicidal behaviour as lying on a continuum where we have an act that results in death by suicide at one end of that continuum. And we have all sorts of things that lead up to that, including thoughts about suicide, self-harm behaviours, behaviours that may result in death and may not result in death, but they're deliberate attempts to harm the self or the person. So we asked, did you have ever thoughts of killing yourself? And 31% of our students were telling us yes, that they did. That's really, really high. The figure in the general population using similar methods is about 8 to 10%, depending on how you ask the question. Almost 20% of our students had made a plan for suicide. Again, that's quite a high figure. Numbers in the general population are much, much lower. And we know that making a plan for suicide is one of the key risk factors then for enacting thoughts of suicide, although suicide can happen in the absence of a plan. And that's where self-harm behaviour becomes quite important there. So one in five of our students were engaging in self-harm behaviour. And self-harm behaviour, I'll talk about it a wee bit later, it's a behaviour that's used to manage stress, but it increases dramatically the risk of suicide because people can self-harm in a way that actually affects their chances of survival. So they can cut themselves to a degree that they might not survive that. And there's this sort of blurred boundary between self-harm and suicide attempt. Some people don't even know when they're self-harming. Are they intending to die, or what is that about? They're just doing it to address the psychological pain that they're experiencing. Of those who self-harmed or attempted suicide, almost half had made more than one attempt, and 15 of our students had attempted suicide in the year prior to attending university. So we have 15 individuals there. So what did we do? We helped them, of course. We had a trigger alert system built into the survey where we could break confidentiality, and we phoned up those students who were saying that they were thinking about suicide or who had attempted suicide, and Inspire Wellbeing Care Call helped us very much with that. There were 84 of our students altogether who triggered that alert and were contacted by Care Call. So why are our students experiencing these mental health problems, and why are they harming themselves? They're doing it to cope with stress. This seems to be the major factor that's influencing the behaviour. A lot of our students seem to be coming to university with pre-existing mental health problems and pre-existing self-harm. So they start this behaviour earlier in life. And when we look at the Northern Ireland Study of Health and Stress, we find that it's teenage years that they're starting. So we actually need to get to them before they come to university in order to prevent this properly. So they're coming to university with pre-existing mental health problems and anxiety. And a lot of that's actually learned behaviour from when they're infants and when they're children. They respond to stress with anxiety. They've been almost programmed right from the start to have a very anxious disposition. And university, of course, is a key life transition. There's lots of stress in that year prior to attending university. The exam stress of A-levels, waiting for results, deciding what course to do. I don't think we're supporting our students in that particular year well enough. So they're coming to us with all of these problems and with events in the past year. So that's a key time period where we should be getting in there. The life transition comes with a new social life, the requirement to make new friends, sometimes to live in a new place, to direct their own learning, and the freedom to experiment with drink, with drugs, with sexual relationships, often for the first time. And that brings a lot of pressure. Sadly, we have a lot of financial pressure on our students nowadays as well. They're leaving university with up to £40,000 of debt. Particularly our international students feel the burden of that. Parents have sacrificed a lot for them to get to university, and the expectations are very, very high. And they also have this pressure to excel that comes from themselves. So social perfectionism is one predictor of suicidal behaviour. If we look at the theories of suicide, we find social perfectionism is right in there, where people, young people nowadays, want to have perfect lives. They want to be that perfect person that we saw on the Geordie Shore. And if they're at university, they want to be the best. They want to get the first. And if they don't, if they feel they're not hitting that, then it can be a threat to their very existence. And sometimes that can lead to thoughts of suicide and suicidal behaviour. Very interesting study conducted by Susan Rasmussen et al. In 2016 looked at self-harm particularly and why people self-harm. And they found that the number one reason was to get relief from a terrible state of mind. So self-harm is used as a way of coping with stress. It's a biological, it produces a biological response that actually addresses the stress response. It helps with that stress activation, that arousal, that very unpleasant feeling. Self-harm helps with that and helps them address that. And it becomes a compulsive thing that they need to do again and again and again. They get into the habit of doing it. So some of us would, I pick my nails when I'm under pressure. I used to twirl my hair. So we all have these wee things that we do to deal with stress. Some people get a wee jiggy leg. Like self-harm's almost like an extreme version of that, where the person is compelled to harm themselves. If you take that away from them, it can become really dangerous, and they can be forced into something that becomes a suicide attempt. So it has to be managed very, very carefully. But it's an important risk factor that we're dealing with and we're seeing in our young people. So what are the predictors in our study? What predicts mental illness? How would we identify the people most at risk, and therefore how would we start to address this? Let's go back a wee minute. So women are more at risk than males. Males are more likely to die by suicide, we know. But in the student groups, women are more at risk, although that gender gap is narrowing. So we need to look at males and females, obviously. Our older students are more likely to have had depression and a suicide attempt. And we think that that's just the longer you're around, the more likely you are to have had these experiences. And sometimes university life, or going back to university as an adult, is associated with divorce and losing your job and things like that. So it can become very therapeutic for the person to go to university and learn. So that's maybe to do with that as well. Number one biggest predictor of mental illness in our student population was being lesbian, gay or bisexual or transgender. And it increased the risk there by up to 5 times. So for mood disorders, it was nearly 3 times. So if you're gay, 3 times the risk of depression, 3.5 times the risk of anxiety, 5.3 times the risk of suicidal thoughts, nearly 6 times the risk of suicide plan, nearly 6 times the risk of suicide attempt. So that group are hugely at risk, and we need to support our LGBT students more clearly. And then 5.4 times for self-harm. There's a lot of talk about ACEs, and we have Margaret here today who worked on this study, and her PhD is on ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences, and they also obviously predicted mental illness in our college student population. They increased the risk of mood disorder by 2.9 times if you had moderate ACEs. So that's neglect, abuse. If you had moderate profiles of those, poverty, 2.9 times. For high ACEs, 3.1. For anxiety disorders, again, nearly 3 times for moderate, but nearly 6 times for high. And suicidal ideation, 4 times and 8 times for high ACEs. Suicide plan, 4 and 8 again, and suicide attempt, 2 and 7. So adverse childhood experiences, again, really predict mental illness in this population. So what should we do? Well, only 10% of our students received help for an emotional problem in the previous year. So there's obviously this big gap. There's this unmet need. So we need to work out how to get those students into services. And we're doing a lot at Ulster, actually, to try and do that. More females than males. Less than 20% of those who met the criteria. So less than 1 in 5 who needed treatment, who would benefit from treatment, received treatment. And remember, at this stage of a person's life, mood disorders, anxiety disorders, all treatable. Even self-harm and suicidal thoughts are all treatable. There's good evidence there. So these students aren't getting the help they need, and they're going to develop other mental health problems as they go through university. They're going to start using more drinking drugs. So it's going to become more and more difficult. We need to get in early. 22.3% would probably not seek help, so stigma is a massive issue there as well. So we know information and awareness can increase stigma if it's done the wrong way. So we can't just tell people about depression and tell them, go and get help. We need to be more creative, because those campaigns actually have been shown not to work. Role models can be very powerful. Knowing somebody with a mental health problem, knowing them before, and then finding out, yeah, you had a problem, you got help, you're grand. That's what we need to be doing, more of that, please. Information on services is really important. Students don't know where to turn to, and they don't know what services are out there for them. Personal recommendations for services are even better. So for somebody to stand up and say, I use CareCall, they were really good, and they really helped me. So practice makes perfect. Students need to actually practice using the language of help seeking for mental illness. They need to practice talking to each other about their mental health, because it's really hard to say those words, are you okay, or I think I need help here, I'm struggling to cope. So we need to give students those skills and the vocabulary to articulate their mental health problems. And finally, we also need ACEs screening and trauma-informed interventions, acknowledging the contextual factors of the troubles. And a lot of these young people have been parented by parents who've had significant exposure to trauma relating to the troubles, and that's what's impacting on their stress responses and their mental health issues in childhood and beyond. And finally, we now know that when we adopt marriage equality, the rates of suicidal behaviour in LGBT people go way down, and that's been demonstrated in several countries, and we're starting to see evidence in the Republic of Ireland for that as well. So we actually need to look at marriage equality as a mental health and suicide prevention issue in Northern Ireland. And now I will pass you on to Elaine, who will tell you all about our fantastic DNA work. Thank you.
Hi, as Siobhan mentioned, in addition to all of this really good survey mental health data that we collected from students, we also collected saliva samples from every student who registered to take part in the study. So although mental health problems, including depression and anxiety, are very, very common, we still don't really understand the biological basis and the mechanisms that can lead to someone developing a mental health problem. We do know that there are very complex interacting biological, social and psychological factors that can lead to someone being susceptible to develop mental health problems. And in our study, we were interested in the overlap between gene and environment interactions. So someone's biological susceptibility is very important, but we know that their environmental exposures, as Siobhan mentioned, their adverse childhood experiences are very important in determining their ultimate risk. So epigenetics is a way in which the environment can interact with someone's genetics to produce changes in their physiology and also then ultimately changes in their behaviour. So we are interested in a particular epigenetic mark, which is called DNA methylation. DNA methylation is a change that can be added to a DNA sequence and can lead to alterations in the expression of genes. So it ultimately leads to a biological change that then down the line can have an impact on behaviour. So we took a subset of the students that we recruited to our study. This was quite a small subset to begin with. These analyses are quite expensive, so we were limited to the number that we could include. But we took 16 people who had no, I call them healthy here, but what is really a healthy control? In our case, it was someone who had not indicated any psychiatric or mental health issues in their life to this point. And then we took age, sex, and smoking-matched cases of depression with comorbid self-harm and suicide attempt. So these are people that met the criteria for a number of different disorders. We then looked at their entire DNA methylation profile. And what we're seeing is a clear separation, first of all, between males and females in terms of their entire DNA methylation profile, which is expected, and that's what you would see, what we expect to see between males and females. They have a very different methylation profile. But what we also see is a separation, a significant separation between female cases of depression and female controls. And when we start to look at what genes, so what physiological processes are being changed by this difference in methylation pattern, what we see is that the genes that are showing the biggest differences in our study are genes related to changes in the immune system. So it's not necessarily what you would think of first as being a cause of changes in mood or emotional regulation, but there is a significant body of evidence now that increases in inflammation and changes in the immune system can underlie the symptoms of depression and can lead to depression in some people. So this was an interesting finding, and we're following up on these findings now to look at specific genes that might be potential markers for depression. And our goal with all of these studies is trying to find particular biological markers that can be used either to help with diagnosis or to help identify what the best treatment is for particular individuals and to design new treatments. So we had lots of saliva, as Siobhan mentioned, and we wanted to make sure that we could do as many things as possible with the saliva samples that we collected. So another area of interest in depression research at the minute is looking at the microbiome. So again, it's not the first thing you would necessarily think of when you think of depression, a link between the brain and the gut. But actually, when we think about our language and the way that we talk about our mood and depression, there are instinctively links there. Like, we talk about having gut reactions and gut feelings. And when you're stressed, you feel butterflies in your tummy. And research lately has started to show that these changes in gut microbiome, so the bacteria and the viruses that live in your gut, if there's imbalances in those, that can have an effect on your mood. So we know that there's a gut microbiome that has an impact on depression. You also have a microbiome lots of other places in your body, including in your mouth. So we took our saliva samples and looked at whether we could see any differences in the microbiome in the oral cavity from saliva between our depressed and our healthy subjects. And this was done actually on a higher number of individuals. So we have about 90 people included in this study. So what we see again here is fairly similar to the separation that we see in the methylation studies. We can see a clear difference between the composition of the oral microbiome between our healthy subjects and our individuals who indicated they had depression. So again, we're following up on these studies now to see if we can find specific bacteria, specific microbes that we could potentially target as therapeutic targets or as biomarkers. The final thing I wanted to mention is that although it seems strange that we're looking at immune system, we're looking at the gut and the microbiome for depression, what we're coming to realise is that there's a big overlap between physical and mental health, and that physical changes that might manifest in some people as diabetes or cardiovascular disease and other people might manifest as depression. And what we're seeing in the students that we have, so these are people who have an average age of 21, so they're quite young. The people who have depression tend to also have higher incidence of other physical health issues as well. So having depression can be a marker or a predictor of poor physical health as well. So it's important that we identify who these people are and try to intervene as quickly and as early as we can. So you can just see there that for every physical health area that we looked at, there was a higher incidence in the people with depression, and the overall number of physical conditions was higher in the depressed individuals. So just to summarise what we've said today, high levels of pre-existing mental health problems were revealed in our student population. Adverse childhood experiences are very important and have a negative impact on mental health and suicidal behaviour. We see that depression is associated with changes in methylation that are related to the immune system and in the microbiome. And these data together suggest that there could be an immune etiology in depression, which is supported by the current literature on the biological components of depression. And I'd just like to acknowledge Margaret McClaverty and Cora Lapsley, who did most of the work that Siobhan and I have presented today, and also to thank the rest of the Ulster Student Wellbeing Study, the Genomics Group and Coleraine, who did the methylation analysis, and the Intelligent Systems Research Group at McGee, who did the microbiome computational analyses for us, and the funders. Thank you.